Colonel Churchill, Reel 7.
Good dear. It transpired, you see, that the Germans at one of the stations, which was not far away, which he knew nothing about, had noticed that one of the signal lights had gone out. That's what they thought. And had come back to see what the trouble was, and had found us there. And we'd wound it down. It hadn't really gone out in a proper way at all. That's why they were there. I think the thing they had is called a shunter's pole, which they hit me with. Anyway, we escaped our second time. And we went on, and on one occasion we stopped at a little working camp, which was full of fairly young Russians. But they were obviously not Germans, because we could hear they were talking, and Jimmy, who could talk Russian, said, by God, these are Russians. So we made ourselves known to them. And they were very good to us. One of them gave me a very crude but pleasant little knife, and they gave us some food, and we gave them some chocolate or something, I think out of Jimmy's Red Cross parcel. Anyway, we had a bit of a harmony with these Russians, and they gave us some glorious hot soup, which they had in a huge tureen, and we spent about an hour with these young Russians. And we said we were Air Force officers and had been bombing Berlin and so on and so forth, and rather exaggerated the damage we'd done and the raids we'd been on and so on and so forth, which they were hugely pleased with and so on. But we had a great harmony with these Russians, and we exchanged one or two things. I think we gave them some of Jimmy's chocolate, and they gave me certainly this knife. And I think they gave us two very ropey sort of obscure hats which suited us down to the ground, which we hadn't got any head covering. But we parted from them on the best terms, and then we moved on again. Another place, we had a bathe. Did I mention the bathe earlier? No, I don't think I did. We had a jolly good bathe in a lake, and we did a shave there to make ourselves more respectable. Then we moved on again. Now, finally, which is very sad how we got captured, and that was a great pity. We'd already survived a third adventure of some sort, which I've forgotten for the moment now. But anyway, the rules in the daytime were, we were nearly always wet at night. Certainly our feet were absolutely soaking, and so were our stockings, and the bottom of our grey trouser legs. So when we got somewhere, we used to break down branches off the trees and make a kind of branch mattress to lift us off the soaking leaves and wet ground. And when we'd made a sort of branch mattress, we then lay on it, and as we were always sleeping the sleep of about three nights before, we usually had not much difficulty in getting to sleep, although we were cold and wet. And we ate something and tried to get some sleep. Now, our boots and socks we took off and stood them, the boots upside down, on sticks about a foot or 18 inches high, hoping that the air would slightly dry the boots up, and the socks we draped about on branches and so on to try and dry them. They were never dry completely, but they were less soaking wet usually when we put them on again before we did our next night's escape. The other thing we also did at night was to take the direction of the setting sun. We had no compass, of course, and we wanted to make sure that our railway line was going in the right direction. So when the sun set, and I knew more about that because of all the commanding I'd done, we took the direction of the prevailing wind, and we said to ourselves, this appears to be a wind coming from the southeast, judging by the sun, which is very slightly north of west. I think this wind is southeast. Well, the direction we want to go to Rostock is so-and-so. So if we keep this wind either extremely blowing in our right ear or behind our neck or whatever is suitable, we'll pretty well know we're going in the right direction, assuming the wind doesn't change. And with any luck, it'll go on the same. So that was always a check, if the stars are covered. Because I knew the stars pretty well. I still do. But we had to take all these sort of additional precautions of things, because we never knew when the night wouldn't be tremendously overcast, and a lot of it was. And we hoped the railway line was going in the right direction, but sometimes the railway line used to bloody well branch. Now, another thing that happened, which I'll tell you about, which is we were saved by James on this occasion. We were going along the railway line, slowly, we walked very slowly, and we were on a very high embankment. And Jimmy said, I'm not sure if we're walking in the right direction. And I said, why ever not? He said, you remember some time ago we were on, I think it was four railway lines, or maybe two railway lines. Now we're only on either one or two. The four had gone down to two, or the two had gone down to one. So there must have been a branch. God, he said, it probably happened when we were on that high embankment, and you said, in the bright moonlight, we're very conspicuous up here, and they have guards on the railway from time to time, which we'd seen on bridges and other places. And we said, if there's a guard anywhere, but they'll see us in the moonlight, right in this prominent place, so we better walk by, keeping the embankment as our line, along the base of it. And then when the embankment dies away, we'll go on the rend again. Well, on that embankment, two lines probably curled off to the left, which might have gone to Rostov. Anyway, Jimmy suddenly said, now there are only two lines instead of four. So there was a branch somewhere, and we must be in the right-hand branch of these two, as we were down on the right of the railway. Now, where this damn line is going, we don't know. So we said, oh, God, this is another problem now. Which direction are we heading in? So we pondered about this, and we said, well, the line, a railway line doesn't go off at right angles. It generally goes off in a curling, simple way. So we don't want to walk the whole way back to find where the bloody branch is and waste a lot of mileage and time. So let us go at right angles to this line. If we go at right angles to this line, we'll probably hit this one, which will have gone off diagonally. So it won't have gone off at a big angle. And with any luck, we'll hit it. So we did that, and to our great joy, after considerable cross-country walking, entirely cross-country then, we hit this other line, and it was the other two. So we said, oh, thank God for that. Anyway, we found the proper place, proper line again now. So we went on.
Now, you were going to talk about your recapture.
Yes. Now... The final thing which led to our capture was a pity, a great pity. And this was Jimmy's fault, because we'd been lying in the damp, sleeping the sleep of three days before on our wooden mattress. And Jimmy, earlier, when he was sitting up and awake, had seen a man, a civilian man, with a dog and a gun. And he said to himself, oh, that's just a farmer with his dog out to shoot a rabbit or something. But the man had not come very near us, and he'd gone away again. So Jimmy had done nothing about it. Now, if he'd told me, I would have made us move, because I wouldn't have been at all happy with the man there. He might have seen us. But again, as he was only one, although he had a gun, he perhaps didn't want to come to us. And I was a great one, always for moving, as we had done previously. Well, a little bit later on, not very long afterwards, evidently, Jimmy said to me, look at those buggers there. And there were three men, I think with two men, with guns. And so we said, oh, God. And Jimmy then said, to my horror, oh, I expect the man I saw earlier with the gun and dog went and got the other two. So I said, what about, who's he? And he said, oh, well, when you were asleep, I saw a man with a dog, and I thought he was just out shooting. So I said, oh, no, we should mention it. We ought to have moved like we did when the German soldier passed. However, if we lie down flat, we'll hope for the best. Well, to our great joy, these Germans moved, we were here, and they moved, and there was going to be a sort of tangent point where they were the nearest to us. And so we lay absolutely flat, hoping that they'd miss us and go further on. However, to our horror, somebody saw something. Anyway, they turned to their right and came towards us with their guns levelled. So I said to Jimmy, shout out at these buggers and tell them that we're English officers. And say, kamerad, say anything. We're not Russians or Poles, anything of that sort. So Jimmy shouted out and said, nix schießen, don't shoot. English officers, nix schießen, I remember that. And so they came up to us. And apart from the fact that they'd been turned out to find us, which annoyed them, and they wasted most of the day, they were quite reasonable. Anyway, they indicated to us, or they said in German, of course Jimmy could talk German as well as Russian, put your boots and things on, which we did. Then we moved off, and we went to a little sort of pub place. And I said to Jimmy, look here, I think now this is the end of the escape for us, so we better eat all that we've got of our food, and let's try and get these people to give us a drink. So Jimmy said to one of these German farmers, can we have a bottle of wine? And they said, nein, but we'll give you some beer. So they got us some beer, which we were very glad to drink. And we wolfed the remains of our stuff and drank this beer. And ultimately, a German NCO came with an escort, and we were taken to the police station, I think in Rostock, on the Baltic. Not Rostov, but Rostock, up there, somewhere there, where I spent one of the nicest, driest nights that I look back in the whole of my life, after this ghastly fortnight's escaping, being wet the whole time and so on. To be in a dry, warm cell was absolute heaven, and good German soup. You were often hearing about watery German soup, which is a lot of rubbish. German soup is marvellous stuff, and very good and very hot and very nice. And we spent a night there, and they then telephoned back to Sachsenhausen, and a van came from Sachsenhausen the next day and picked us up and took us back to our camp. And to begin with, we were chained, handcuffed and chained to the floor. In the middle of my cell, there was a strong point in the middle of the floor, and there was a meter-long chain. And round one ankle, I was chained to this floor, because they were so terrified of our escaping and so on, particularly these other four, who had been escapers all along. They said, the Germans are very afraid of the Navy, and they're very afraid of the English Secret Service. And I think they were very frightened of these confirmed escapers, Dedaus, James and Dodge, who had done escapes earlier. And so they were taking no chances with us. And there we were. And in due course, not only that, but they then moved us every fortnight into a different cell. So that if, in the unlikely event, we'd been able to do anything out of the cell, we then found ourselves in a new cell. Of course, it was quite impossible to do anything out of a cell. But it shows the precautions they were taking to avoid any other getaway. But that is pretty well the end of the story. But the great pity was that we didn't move that last time when the Folkestern, the Home Guard farmers, found us. Because we were very close to the harbour there, and we could have, by being careful, have made contact, because all the ships were coming down from the Nordic countries supplying coal and iron and wood and all sorts of things to the Germans, and we had no difficulty, we'd have had no difficulty making contact with some sailor or somebody, and partly bribed him to help us to get onto some ship and get across the Skagerrak or Kattegat or whatever it was, and go in either Norway or Finland or Sweden or somewhere. was very sad.
Could I ask you if you ever discovered why it was that you were put in a concentration camp instead of a POW camp?
No, I had three things against me. My name was Churchill. I was commanding a commando. And I had been helping Tito. And in the original stages, they said, "You're a bandit." So I said, "I'm not a bandit. Of course I'm not a bloody bandit. I'm an ordinary soldier. You captured me in a perfectly good battle." They said, "Yes, but you're working with these bandits, Tito, these partisans." So I said, "Only incidentally." I said, "You're the bandits. You can talk to Germans like this. You're invading the whole of ruddy Europe. You invaded Russia to begin with. You invaded Yugoslavia. You invaded France. You invaded Belgium. You're the bandits, not us. We are trying to get you out and send you back to your own country." And he says, "That is where you can talk to Germans very well. They don't mind that, you see." They said, "Oh, well, you think you have a point there. But no, that the only reason for that is economic and so on, and there's pressure being brought us on the colonies and so on and so forth. But they have a very thin case."
Why should the fact that you were called Churchill have made a difference to you?
Well, they thought they had a good prisoner in Churchill, and they kept saying, "Your relation to the Prime Minister." So I said, "No, I'm not. I have no relation whatever to the Prime Minister." I went out of my way to say how remote we are. I said, "There are millions of Churchills, and all the Prime Minister's gang are mostly politicians and so on. But we're not. We're all soldiers. I had a brother who's a soldier, and I have another brother who's a sailor who's been killed in the war already. We're all entirely a military branch of the family. It may be part of the same clan or tribe, you might say, but they're totally remote from us." I said, "I've never seen the Prime Minister." Now, I had missed a glorious opportunity of having lunch with the Prime Minister and Randolph, just the three of us, one day in, I think it was Algiers. When I was in Africa getting recruits for my commando, I told you I went around to these foreign places and I got these foreigners, of whom the Germans were the best. Randolph had been staying in the Aletti Hotel, was it, in Algiers? And I'd known Randolph a bit. He'd been attached to my commando for a short time at one period. And I was there, and Randolph was there. And Randolph, whose father, Winston, had and did, during the war, use him to a great extent as a kind of agent or spy. He got a lot of information from Randolph, which supplemented the information he got from official sources. But he and Randolph were very close, and always were very close, and he thought he could ask Randolph all sorts of personal questions about higher-ups in the Army, Navy, and Air Force, and get jolly good replies from Randolph. Also, Randolph, again like his father, traded on the fact that his father, Prime Minister, and particularly with the Americans and foreigners, used to get all kinds of advantages and mainly movements from them. He used to get the Air Force to fly him to places. He used to get the Navy to give him lifts where they're appropriate. And he was always swanning around. He knew Bob Laycock very well, who commanded the Commando Brigade. That is how, for a short time, he was commandoing. And as my name was Churchill already, Bob Laycock gave him to me. And I had Randolph for a bit. And I've got one very nice letter from Randolph, which I kept. I had about three or four letters with Randolph that I exchanged different times. But I've only got one now. But it's a very nice little one, quite an illuminating one. And I have that still, which I could show you. But Randolph was good-hearted in many ways. And he once, when he went to Russia, sent me some caviar, I think it was, which again was brought by the Air Force somehow. But Randolph said, "I enjoyed very much the week or fortnight it was, as with your commander, and you must like this stuff. So I'm getting the Air Force to bring this stuff to you." And he sent me a little tin of caviar, which was very nice and thoughtful of him. But that's the kind of thing that Randolph sometimes did. He was good-hearted and so on, and did things of that kind.